Good evening. My name is Paul Holdengraber, and I'm the Director of Public Programs at the New York Public Library, now known as Live from the New York Public Library. Expect Wasabi is a new motto for this season. No more lions roaring. I'm sure many of you will be relieved. Last night, we had Bernard-Henri Lévy and Žižek. There was quite some wasabi, and I expect with James Wood and Daniel Mendelssohn, there will be plenty, as they are deftly and nimbly guided and goaded by Pico Aya. On Friday, come here, Robert Badinter. I don't know how many of you have met Robert Badinter. It may be the last time he comes to this country. He was the Minister of Justice under the first François Mitterrand regime. He probably single-handedly abolished capital punishment. As you know, capital punishment is one of the topics we never see in our presidential races, but I think it's a very important topic to investigate. America is probably the last democracy where capital punishment exists in 29 states. Also, next week, come and hear Antonio Lobo Antunes, one of the very, very great Portuguese writers, Céline Curiel and Paul Auster. And to finish us up next week, maybe to finish me up, I will have the pleasure of interviewing James McBride and Spike Lee. To find out more, I encourage all of you to join our email list. And now let me tell you a little bit how this evening will happen, or so I imagine. First of all, there'll be a conversation which will last about as long as a psychoanalytical session. It will be followed by a Q&A period. I ask you to legibly write questions down, which will be brought to me at various moments throughout the evening. Legibly is important because I do need to be able to read them, and then I will make a very difficult decision of choosing a few. I encourage you to write questions that are questions rather than long comments. That is the advantage, actually, for me to ask you to write them. 192 books will be selling the books of our authors tonight. This will happen right after the event, so please come up and purchase their books. I could not be happier tonight than to be welcoming James Wood, Daniel Mendelssohn, and Pico Aya as they return to another Live from the New York Public Library event. Pico gave us a title and a description for the evening tonight, which he agreed to instigate. Reading in the World of Images. Does the common reader exist in our world of splitting screens? Pico Aya asks. Where might we find beauty, seriousness, or moral passion among our fraying books? And does it even make sense to put Flaubert, Homer, and Oliver Stone into the same sentence? Two of the defining public critics of our times, James Wood, and a passionate reader who creates cathedrals out of words, and Daniel Mendelssohn, a professional classicist bringing rigor to the popular arts, investigates a space where reading ends and real criticism begins. I, for one, and I'm sure many of you as well, do not wish reading to end. None of us do, I think, and it probably won't. Pico Aya will be introducing James Wood and Daniel Mendelssohn to you in just a moment. Pico Aya studied nothing but literature, he tells us, for 8 years at Eton, Oxford, and Harvard, and regularly writes literary essays for the New York Review of Books, Harper's, the TLS, American Scholar, among others. He's the author of 2 novels, Abandon and Cuba and the Night, as well as 7 works of nonfiction, including Video Night in Kathmandu, The Lady and the Monk, The Global Soul, which is truly one of my very favorite. I remember many years ago, maybe 7 years ago, Pico Aya came to Los Angeles and performed actually the week he spent living at LAX when he lived in the airport. And he's written most recently The Open Road, an account of 33 years of talks and travels with the 14th Dalai Lama. We spoke about that together just a few months ago. It gives me really great, great pleasure to welcome Pico Aya and his guests.
Mm. Well, thank you very much. I think the simple way to put that introduction is that I'm the luckless fool who asks all the questions you wish I weren't asking, and who gets you to roll your eyes by not asking the urgent or germane or follow-up questions you wish I were asking. But as you heard, you'll get the chance to do that. And I'm just really so touched to see so many people here, and I think another room upstairs, you're almost suggesting by your presence that the book has a future, and that literary criticism isn't a relic of the 20th or even the 19th century. So thank you all for coming. You're here clearly because you know James Wood and Daniel Mendelsohn. So I'll just say very briefly, as you probably know already, James is chief fiction critic for The New Yorker. He's a professor of the practice of literary criticism at Harvard. And I think he's most important, the author of four books. His first, The Broken Estate, is the only book of literary criticism I've ever foisted on my friends again and again for Christmas presents and birthday presents. A dazzling meditation, really, on how literature has begun to fill the space perhaps left by religion after it abdicated its position at the center of culture in the middle of the 19th century. His next book was The Irresponsible Self. He wrote a novel, The Book Against God. And I think much more important than any of that, James is the rare person who really suggests that reading and writing are important and that they have stakes. And I think who brings to the text the kind of keen, close attention, the furious engagement, and the sense of wonder that many other people might bring to scripture. And I will say that in my life as a reader and writer, he's the only critic who's made me feel that reading and writing are honorable professions and worthy of love and worthy of really caring about. Daniel, as all of you know, is a professor at Bard, and a distinguished scholar of the classics who seems to be able to write in pretty much every form. He wrote a memoir, The Elusive Embrace. He's written a scholarly study of Euripides. He's about to come out with a two-volume translation of Cavafy next spring from Knopf. And he's the author of the huge excavation of history, personal and collective, around the Holocaust called The Lost. The Lost won the National Book Critics Circle Award last year. Daniel had earlier won the National Book Critics Circle citation for reviewing. He won the George Jean Nathan Award for Drama Criticism. And I think one of the things that really distinguishes him is that most of us have probably read him constantly in the New York Times Book Review, The New Yorker, formerly New York Magazine, and especially the New York Review of Books, bringing his eye really to everything, from Philip Roth to Oliver Stone, from Michael Crichton to, in fact, James Wood. I think what really stands out uniquely about Daniel's writing is that he brings this high, rigorous, classical eye to the stuff that's around us and to books and films and popular fiction, and perhaps elevates them in the process. James's most recent book is How Fiction Works, came out just a few weeks ago, really a classical handbook to the tools of fiction, characterization, detail, point of view. Happily, the rare book of literary criticism that actually made it to the New York Times extended bestseller list. Daniel has just brought out a book a few weeks ago, a huge collection of essays called How Beautiful It Is and How Easily It Can Be Broken, which comes from Stage Directions by Tennessee Williams, and collects his musings on everything from Almodovar to Wolfgang Petersen, from Tarantino to Stoppard to Hausman to Wilde, to many others. And it's interesting, it instantly strikes me that both of them have used in the titles of their books the word broken, as if to suggest there's been some fundamental rift in the last few years and a certain contract that obtained between reader and writer or between society and book has been broken. And I suppose the natural place to begin is to ask you, James, that every other time I open a magazine, I find a piece by you, but nearly always on literature. And I'm not aware of your having chosen to train your eye on other forms. Is that because you worry that literature is... are you fighting a rearguard action, or are you celebrating something that people care about?
I'm celebrating something I know about. I know about music and play music, but I feel unqualified in some way to write about music, so I steer clear of it. I think, you know, the old, it's the Kierkegaard thing, purity of will, of heart is to will one thing. There's something to be said for mining as deeply as you can in one form and in more or less one genre. So that's why I plug away at it.
And how do you choose the books you write about? Because this current book is really a work of appreciations, I feel. But in the past, you've written a lot about authors you don't seem to cherish so much.
Well, I get, of course, I could choose what to write about. It's a combination, as ever, of choosing and having things chosen for you. the new book, How Fiction Works, came in some ways out of teaching. I've been teaching in the last 3 or 4 years part time at Harvard, and I've also done a few master classes at Columbia with the MFA students. In some ways, I prefer those classes with writers who are thinking hard about matters of technique and craft, and who are studying authors to see what they can do themselves as writers in imitation. So I felt that there was a certain amount of stuff going on in classes that could stand being codified in some way in a book. And when you think about it, there aren't very many. I mean, when I was 20, I wanted a kind of general guide to the novel that was distinct from the academic work that I was reading, and it's not to denigrate that had its use too, but I wanted a sort of writerly text, and there aren't very many. There are Kundera's great 3 books now on fiction. There's the somewhat elderly Forster now, Forster's Aspects of the Novel, but there isn't much in the way of a general essay around matters of technique, so it seemed fun to do.
But were you looking for that age 20 as a potential critic or as a would-be writer or as just a delighted reader?
Well, at 20, I mean, I was a very zealous aspirant writer. So
of creative prose.
Yeah, of creative prose and wanting to, you know, thinking intently about writing creatively. And so I felt I needed help. Or it's not, I don't know if there's help that one needs. One needs company. You go to criticism for it.
And, I mean, I think of you as distinctly, almost self-consciously public in what you're doing. And you're addressing the things that everybody is talking about, but you're addressing them from a different angle, perhaps. Is that part of your conscious plan? Or?
Well, I mean, I don't, you know, I wish I had a conscious plan. I think, you know, to a certain extent, my training as a classicist informs a lot of what I do in the sense that, you know, when we look at literature, we meaning scholars of the classics, we look at the entire surround. You know, you don't just read Homer and not look at Bronze Age implements that are being dug up and forms of justice and the, you know, the 800s BC. And so, you know, so you get used to I would say contextualizing a lot because it's a necessary part of what you do. You can't, as a classicist, you know, you can't focus on the plays of Euripides and not care that the Peloponnesian War also was going on. At the, you know, so you have to know history, art, everything. You know, it's all the surround. And I think it just, I didn't have a plan. You know, I just, when I started, because I left that world, that's the joke, you know. As my sainted grandmother used to say, man plans and God laughs. you know, when I left the classics and decided I wanted to be a writer, and I really wanted to be a critic, I mean, that's really what I wanted to grow up to be. It's not a sort of faute de mieux fallback position. It just, that's just how I ended up writing about things. You know, for example, you know, like when I was reading the Alice Sebold book, The Lovely Bones, you know, it seemed to me that the only way that you could write about that book to, in a way that was, to me, interesting was to, in fact, enlarge the focus from the book itself, which is, you know, a completely okay mid-level novel, and to try to understand why that book had that impact at that moment. And for that, I thought you needed to think about 9/11, you know. So I think I'm public, which is an interesting word only because I was trained in a funny way to look at how everything works together, you know.
And to read the culture as much as the text before.
I would say to read the culture. I would never call myself a cultural critic. You know, I just think I'm somebody who focuses on, I mean, sort of my stock in trade, obviously, as people know who read the New York Review, is to sort of often see how a contemporary interpretation of a classic, whether the classic is, you know, the life of, a Greek play, or as I just did, Brideshead Revisited, or whatever, and to see how the space between the original and the reinterpretation tells you something about our moment, I would say.
And maybe what also tells us about our moment is that your training is in classical literature, but the forms you're working with in this book, probably the majority are films and plays, wouldn't you say? They're actually performance pieces more than literary texts.
Yeah, which surprised, you know, when I first started writing, you know, when you first start writing, I don't know if this is true for James, but, you know, you write about anything because you've got your rent to pay. You know, I did an article about food courts in Las Vegas, you know, I mean, so that's true. You know, I was often asked to review books, you know, because I had a PhD, so people figured I was literate. And I was always, you know, and I wrote for a lot of gay magazines because that's how I sort of got into writing in this niche kind of way. And what's interesting to me about my own sort of looking back is how I ended up going away from books and doing this really being interested in the theater, I would say, although I always come at it from, I would say, a purely literary angle. Yeah. You know, I'm always looking at the text. I'm always starting with the text and how does that get you someplace, whether it's the producers or Euripides, and I take both equally seriously when I'm reviewing them, you know.
And I think there's a real shape to this book of essays. You say at the beginning that it's an intellectual autobiography, and at first that has a kind of Wildean sound to it, but I think it's really true that out of the many pieces you've written, you've chosen these and you've arranged them. And I felt that you really were developing an idea about what a gay sensibility or gay perspective, because it seemed whether it's Hausman or John Boswell or Wilde or Noel Coward, that's something running through all 400 pages.
Yeah, I think to a certain extent that's true. You know, it raises a question that's inevitable and of a large interest, I think, which is the extent to which the sort of the life of the critic is a fundamental factor in the criticism. You know, there's an issue that people think about a lot, and one knows about this because, you know, we read the blogs too, you know, which is, you know, how who you are determines your reaction to things. And, you know, on the one hand, and it's very interesting, you know, on the one hand, who I am obviously has a lot to do with what I like, you know. And on the other hand, I would say, and I'd be very interested to hear what you both think about this, that what I like is also the first impulse that I dismiss when I start writing about something, you know, that you're always sort of oscillating between a kind of abstract notion of what ought to be the case and your own response to something. And I think in that space can be some very interesting kinds of writing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to come back to that, but first I want to ask James provocatively, are the things that you choose who you are? Many of your readers, including one called Daniel Mendelsohn, have suggested that the circumstances of your life have shaped very much and clearly the sensibility you bring to that. Isn't the first person you quoted tonight was Kierkegaard, which is interesting.
Yeah, no, of course. Just speaking personally, it was fascinating to publish a novel because I found that whatever the reviews were, and there were nice ones and not so nice ones, I was relatively untouched by them. And you'd think it'd be the other way, that the novel would be the more personal, confessional vessel. And actually, I find that when people are reviewing my criticism, I get very personally involved and hurt, and I want to fight back and feel that they must see things the way I do, or there's something wrong with them. This is the, you can't be a critic unless you operate on that principle, right? Somehow the novel, rightly so, was more like something you just push out and, you know, like a child or something that is yours but is not yours. So yes, I think there's always there's quite an intense buried personal inflection in these in any decent critic's work, and I'm perfectly prepared to accept. I mean, I grew up in a religious household. It was very not very. It was reasonably evangelical, shall we say? Sort of not quite American evangelicalism, more like an English version, which is more like Victorian evangelicalism than the full born again. So not incompatible with liberal politics, for instance. But nevertheless, scriptural and austere. And I think I was aware as a teenager of transferring an inherited familial zeal from religious texts onto those things, that the secular texts that I was so busily reading. And I, of course, that's there in the work.
Mm. And you're in the happy position for a literary critic of being read and discussed a lot, and therefore sometimes challenged a lot. I'm wondering, have you learned things from the people who bring criticisms against your criticism?
Yeah, I have, because I think you can't be an important critic unless you remain very, very curious. It's why, for instance, I think Alex Ross is such a terrific music critic. I mean, he's a wonderful music critic because he has the real art of redescription, which most people don't. Mm-hmm. You know, it's amazing how many art critics do everything except bring alive on the page the canvas they're talking about. But he can do it brilliantly with music, and more to the point, he has a very, you know, wide-angled curiosity about all forms of new music. I know myself to lack in some ways that curiosity, and it's something I struggle with, because I don't think you can be a serious critic without some of that continuing interest in what's being produced. Otherwise, of course, you're going to be wandering around a cemetery of touchstones, and just, you know, being the Arnoldian that one is accused of being, which I'm not. But you know, yes, you've got to stay alive.
Did you find that your criticism changed after you wrote a novel and after you really experienced firsthand being on the other side of the table?
No, it didn't much. Daniel, in his review of my novel, said it would, or it might, and it didn't. I think, actually, if I'm a slightly sweeter critic than I used to be, it's partly because I live with a novelist. And we know from the Bill and Hillary Clinton thing that, it's, of course, everything's more painful when it happens to one's spouse than to you, right? I mean, this is a truth.
Especially if you didn't.
So, you know, after a while, the business of bringing with a shaking hand the negative review to the person you live with and having to be asked to read it out gets to you, I think, and you're aware of what you can do to people as a writer when you review their work. So I'm probably a bit gentler on that.
What you're bringing up raises a question that everybody thinks about when they think about critics and criticism, which is the wound factor, you know. From my mind, a sort of a crucial thing that I always am trying, like a madman, to emphasize is that. We were once on a panel together, and I think I made the same point. You know, having as when you're trained as a classicist, you're used to thinking that everyone you're writing about is dead. You know, for a long time. You know, but I, people always ask you know, how easy I had it. But I think, you know, people always say, oh, well, do you think about the feelings of the people that you're... And I say, no. And I don't want anyone to think about my feelings when they're reviewing my book either, because I, you know, and this is a sort of hobby horse of mine, but I think that the, you know, the obligation is to literature, say, you know, and to the activity of literature, and that I think it's insulting if you're worried about the feelings of an author, because the person whose feelings you should be worried about, so to speak, is literature. You know, does this book make a claim? You know, does it attain to seriousness? Is it going to do something in the world? And that's the criterion for judging it. And I think that's crucial to say, because, you know, there's a general sense. Look, let's just bat the eight ball into the open here. You know, there's a general idea of critics as people, you know, sort of a slightly lower level of life who are filled with resentments and beefs and you know, have power. You know, I always love that one. And, you know, I don't know about James, but I only write about things that are interesting to me, because it's usually something I want to work out for myself. I don't think about the author. I don't think about anybody else, except why it's interesting and what's either wrong with it or right with it, or usually both. And I think it's important to sort of bring this out into the open, because I think people, you know, a lot of people have a very loony notion of what motivates critics. And, you know, I, in my own book, which in order to explain this long, but I like to think very beautiful title, you know, critics write because they love their subject. They don't care about people, so to speak. They don't care. I don't become a critic because I think writers are nice. God knows, quite the opposite usually. You know, but you know, you like your thing and you want to protect it from damage in a funny way. I would say that's a strong impulse, and so I don't think about the people. And I've written other kinds of books myself, and I don't. I don't want somebody to say, well, should I not say this critical thing because then he'll have a bad day? No, because I think you're taking me more seriously if you're talking about my book and not worrying about me.
Yeah, yeah.
But you could say that Wolfgang Petersen's epic movie Troy, or a Broadway production about the invention of love or something like that, that they shouldn't, that it's not really fair to bring to them the standards or criteria you would bring to high literature, and that literature isn't wounded when there's some huge, splashy three-hour Hollywood spectacle because it's aimed at a different audience and to serve a different need.
Well, I mean, my first response to that is that the only, you know, to a certain extent, what differentiates between high literature and, let's say, other literature is, you know, we're not going to know the difference quite often until 2,000 years from now. So, it's a distinction that we sort of recognize in a funny way, but also one I'm a little bit reluctant to get into. You know, Greek tragedy was a form of mass entertainment in its day. Everybody went to see it, right? So I don't know what's high literature, you know, but I think that if somebody engages in the activity of creating something that's interesting and aspires to seriousness, whether it's, you know, I think The Producers is a very serious, not the recent one, but the original movie in a tradition of comic engagement with the world. I think that was a serious undertaking. I think Tom Stoppard in The Invention of Love was doing something serious. You know, I think Wolfgang Petersen, when he made Troy, although, you know, Hollywood is a different set of considerations because of the money, but, you know, was trying to do something. I don't think anybody wakes up in the morning, well, I could name some names, but, you know, I think most people who are creative don't wake up and say, oh, I'm going to put one over on the public. I think people want to do something that's engaged, and that's the criterion by which you judge it, by its own premises in a funny way, you know. And if you're, for example, in the Alice Siebold case, you know, just because everyone loved that except me, you know, if you write that novel and you think it's saying serious things about death and suffering and redemption, whatever that word means anymore, you know, then okay, fine, let's talk about death and suffering and redemption, because, you know, I know a lot of serious works that are about that, you know. So I'm not going to determine what's high or low, but I think seriousness of intent and adequacy of execution are the things that I'm interested in, whether it's the producers or Euripides. You know, if you're going to put it on, I'll go and look, you know.
So 2,000 years from now, we may assess new works in the light of Oliver Stone's Alexander, or
for
who knows,
all I know, you
that
know.
May be the Euripides of the future.
But that's I mean, it's an interesting point, because as we know, canon, you know, what becomes the exemplary texts of a culture is not necessarily the ones that everybody loved.
Yeah.
You know, in antiquity, the play of Euripides that everybody thought was the really hot one was one called Orestes, which nobody reads anymore, except people like me, you know. So, you know, we never know, because we're in the moment.
Yeah.
You know, books that were, you think of the writers who were huge in their time, and deservedly huge, Fontana, Galdós, you know, people that have disappeared off the face of the earth.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We don't know,
yeah.
because we're too close to it.
Andrew Del Banco's biography of Melville, there's a fascinating little line or two where he's talking about how unimportant Melville was as a writer in the culture when he, how unknown, obscure he was when he died. And he says, Del Banco says, there's only one reference in the whole of Henry James's work to Melville, and it's a roundup reference to the stable of Putnam's writers or something like that.
Yeah.
He just says, you know, the Putnam's writers like Melville. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
That's an important thing. And so to go back to what you were saying, I think you're absolutely right. It isn't, I may feel it more acutely than you do for whatever reason, for whatever mad insanity, this feeling of the hurt feelings of the author. But I agree that in principle this is not one's concern. Instead, one's anxiety must be about, and perhaps this is what I meant more. Anxiety is about being terribly wrong. You know, if as you say, you're protecting something from damage, then you must not be the damager, and you don't. It's hard to, you know, there are. If I go back to what was the first thing I did when I arrived at the New Republic in 1996, was I started looking through 1995. I went through all the archives for fun, you know, just because they were all there, the old magazines, and there is Mary McCarthy's review of that great Christina Stead novel, *Man Who Loved Children*, and there's nothing wrong with it as a review. It's a brief sort of 1,000-word notice, you know. And it's actually not a pan at all. She can see the quality of it, but it's so blithely disdainful in the end. Compared to if you compare what that review, if you put the review up against the labor it took to produce that book, the agonies of producing that book, and the quality of the book, that it's a horrifying lesson, I think, in what we. What we need to be careful of as critics, because we can all be, I think, too. I don't know. It's not about being dismissive. It's about not taking things seriously enough, and as you say, to some extent, on their own terms.
Not looking closely enough. Because
not looking closely enough.
Are there pieces you've written you would like now to rewrite or to take back?
I don't know if exactly. Yes, I think not to take back, but there are things I would have liked more time. Obviously, one of the things this is something we can talk about, is one doesn't have time. I think it's what I enjoy about teaching, is that I can spend 3 weeks reading A House for Mr. Biswas, or a month reading A House for Mr. Biswas with students, 150 pages a week, as opposed to, you know, knowing that in 3 weeks' time I've got to review the new biography of V.S. Naipaul, which will mean, you know, if I'm lucky, a quick glance again at Biswas. Maybe I can have a read of, you know, In a Free State again. And, you know, do you know what I mean? It's just you're patching it together as quickly as you can. And it has its own potency, but there's something lost. So, yes, I would have liked more time. I was very struck by something that I read earlier this year. I don't know whether it's complete nonsense or whether it's really fundamentally true. It was the great music critic and musicologist Hans Keller, who wrote a lot in Britain in the 40s and 50s. And he's talking about, I think it's a little essay about the that an annoyingly mnemonic theme to the third man, you know, da 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 da, you know that one. And he sort of hates it as a tune, but he can't get it out of his head, and so he's interested in, so he does a musical analysis of why it's so catchy. And in the course of that review, he says in that piece, he says something like, "When I hate, as soon as I hate something, I ask myself why I like it so much." Now, that has to be in some way untrue. I mean, you couldn't simply, you'd turn into a lunatic if you worked on that principle throughout your life. But it isn't a bad thing to have above your desk as a critic.
And I always sense in your writing there's an attempt to teach the reader how to read in some ways. Or not if not to teach,
yeah,
to give them...
For sure, yeah. No, I mean, one of the things I very much felt I benefited from at university with the chance of studying literature was that I was sure when I graduated that I'd been taught how to read, that I'd arrived at 18 with some fairly inchoate ideas of what a text was and how to go through it line by line, and I was at a university in which the whole notion of close reading and practical criticism had been largely invented in the 1920s, so there was still a great emphasis on practical criticism, though in fact I was being taught by a theorist, not by an old-fashioned practical criticist, but by a post-structuralist, but he was a very good close reader, and I felt for sure 3 years later that I'd been taught how to read. It's something I try to do, obviously, with the students, but try to enact it also in my criticism.
I was just backstage wondering if students really read the way, with all the diversions in the world now, the way they did 40 years ago. And you were giving a stirring defense of them as a sometime professor.
Well, I don't know how they were 40 years ago, but I do, because I teach in a very limited way, but I do am always teaching something. You know, there tends to be a lot of anxiety and breastfeeding about the state of literature and literacy, and, you know, it's serious. I think we're in a serious situation. But, you know, what always impresses me about freshmen is how, you know, that they're true believers. You know, they want to believe that great literature is great and that will do something for them. I mean, in my experience, you know, and I take that very seriously, you know, as long as there are people like that. But I think that's true in general. I mean, I've done some reading groups and, you know, for example, I mean, when I was on my book tour, you know, you go out there and you meet lots of people, and there's the, you know, the country is filled with people who want to read. You know, they just tend not to occupy positions of high governmental importance. but you know, so and that gives me a lot of comfort. People believe, you know, they want to believe. Mm. And I think to some extent, you know, I feel responsible to those people. You know, I don't feel responsible to authors, but I feel responsible to readers and publics, because I do write about films and plays, you know, like telling them what I think is the way to look at something, because they are, you know, interested. Mm. I take the public very seriously, and they're the people I'm talking to when I'm not just talking to myself, you know. And I think this teaching experience keeps reinforcing, to me at least, that the world is filled with readers, you know. It will always be the case. They may be reading, you know, 1,000 years from now on a chip implanted in the palm of their hand, but that doesn't mean they don't want narrative any less than we do, or any less than people did 1,000 years ago.
It's interesting, even V.S. Naipaul, whom I think of almost as sort of high priest in the Church of Letters, who's consecrated his life to the word. I think he said if he was starting over now, he would go into movies, that that has become the dominant narrative. And even this man who's, you know, such a believer in literature seems to suggest literature's moment is over.
But I think, this raises, I think, an absolutely crucial question. You know, literature is a very wide pool, and we can all jump in it. You know, literature is the hymn to the son of Akhenaten, the Egyptian pharaoh. It's the letters of Madame de Sévigné. It's the journals of John Cheever. It's the poems of Sappho, who never saw a piece of paper in her entire life and never wrote a word in her life. It's certainly ditto for Homer. You know, we're attached to writing. I always prefer to talk about narrative, you know, about texts, maybe, because, you know, literature is big. Literature is Oscar Wilde and Tennessee Williams and, you know, Tom Stoppard. And, you know, those are not texts that you read necessarily. So I think we'll be more comforted if we restrict literature to books. You know, books may, but look, I just got my dad's birthday, it was 2 days ago. He's sitting here in the front row, and I got him an Amazon Kindle. You know, I guarantee you in 100 years, you know, that's what we're going to be reading on. And who knows? You know, so I think, you know, this is where I think having a certain long view, because I'm always thinking in 1,000-year chunks, you know, that's comforting. You know, there, what I think has been persistent, to go out on a limb here, you know, is what people have always wanted, you know, from Ugg sitting around the cave until yesterday at 6 o'clock, was a good story. You know, that doesn't seem to have diminished. The stories are different, they're complicated, sometimes they're hysterical, you know, but but that seems to be a constant. So I think if you think of it very widely, it's you're less panicked. It's just because we're in a funny moment, as I hope we're going to talk about, because there's a lot of different forms of distribution that are changing the way we think about texts, you know. But it's, I think it's okay, you know.
I mean, I actually think of James, sorry. But
no, I was going to say, I mean, I'd actually like to ask you, Pico. I mean, Daniel and I are likely to give pretty sanguine answers to those questions, because we, of course, spend our time surrounded by people, more or less, who are reading and writing and thinking about reading and writing, so it looks fine. I'd be happy to talk in a minute about why I am reasonably sanguine in the way that Daniel is about things, but I sense from you, and you live in Japan, and you don't live and work in a university setting, I sense from you a kind of resignation or pessimism. And I'd like to know what, I mean, I'd be
well,
interested in what
the sources
are. Well, I spend
4 months, 4 months every year in California. but beyond that, I go to the bank and there's a screen where usually I would have stood in the bank line and read my novel. I get on a plane next week, a Singapore Airlines plane, and as I get into my economy seat, there are 100 movies, including Kurosawa, Ozu, Fellini, Godard, you name it, art house movies. And I realize that even I, whose livelihood depends on writing, is going to find it very difficult to pick up a book in the face of such temptations, and more so were I 25 years younger than I am. On my way over here, as I wanted to think about the future of literature, there in the screen of the taxi, there in the back of the taxi,
is
a screen generating People.com's 5 top celebrities, as well as the Zagat Guide and ESPN. And so I suppose I just feel the pressure of temptation and realize the way in which even I cannot resist many of those temptations. And, you know, one thing, not to turn it back on you, but one thing I love about your book, this current book, is a sense that you are trying to pick out those precise places where literature can operate that nowhere else can. I mean, you're the sort of king of free indirect speech, but beyond that, you're alighting on James or Proust or Flaubert as if to suggest they are doing things that the camera, the tape recorder, multimedia will never be able to get to, places inside ourselves. So, I mean, it's maybe not a conscious thing, but it seems to be close to your heart.
Yeah, I think it's not a conscious thing only because I don't feel equipped necessarily to fight that battle, or at least I don't have I don't have a strong enough sense of the enemy, perhaps, and so I'd rather do it as you suggest, implicitly or suggestively. I mean, there is a lot, of course, a lot more visual distraction around, and just a lot more rubbish. But it has been with us now for quite a while. I mean, if you go back to the solidly realist American novels of the 50s and 60s, whether it's Herzog or, I mean, not solidly realist actually at all, I take that back. I shouldn't even use a term like that because there isn't such a term, there isn't such a thing. But the less formally experimental, more repertorial novels like Herzog or Seize the Day or Yeats's Revolutionary Road, they're already registering an extraordinary amount of confusion and presence of advertising and rival languages and discourses and so on. In fact, they seem very prescient books. I think when DeLillo came to write Cosmopolis, he was essentially just rewriting Seize the Day, just not as well. It was a weak miswriting. But so, I mean, this isn't entirely new. There's more of it, right?
It's accelerating very quickly.
It's accelerating very, very quickly. But look, I mean, in some ways, it seems to me actually almost the other way around, that we're this also may be a source of anxiety, that we're freakishly protected from it to some extent. I mean, here we are up on stage, you know, having a chat that could easily have be parodied by Monty Python. Do you know what I mean? You know, this is, why is this any different from 40 years ago? The pipe would have the pipe and, you know, so on. I defer to you and you defer to me and then you defer to him and he defers to me.
We'd all be smoking.
It seems to me, for instance, that we're in actually a very good period for criticism. Why is it the case that if Edmund Wilson or Randall Jarrell came back from the dead, they would be at all horrified by the state of things in American letters? There are there's The Nation, The New Republic, The New York Review of Books, Harper's, Atlantic, The New Yorker, Book Forum, not to mention a whole host of other things that I haven't even gone electronic yet, where long essays are being written by serious critics who, present company excepted, are actually, I think, a lot more incisive and scholarly and intellectual than was the general standard 30, 40 years ago, which, of course, is precisely what you would expect as two or three generations worth of essentially graduates in literature come out of the universities. Particularly, perhaps, as theory's been absorbed and the theory wars are over and so on. There's a rigor and a seriousness to, you know, say, when Ian McEwan publishes something like Saturday, Saturday gets a serious, you know, 3,000 or 4,000-word consideration 5 or 6 times in different magazines. I don't think there's no sign of ill health in that regard.
But, I mean, it seems to me that the sense is that what there wasn't 40 years ago was all the everything else. You know, I think there's a sort of perception by people who say enjoy this kind of discourse that you were talking about, which is, say, an old-fashioned one, let's just call it that for the time being, that those, and this, of course, goes to the heart of what a lot of people are interested in, those people never had any competition, right? Mm. They were writing in the New Republic, they were publishing in the New York Times, and there wasn't 30 million people with laptop computers saying what they thought of Moby Dick or whatever. And so I think that this sense of panic that exists in certain quarters of the literary or public, I'm not going to say the producers, but the readers, and, you know, comes from a sense of a sort of destabilized feeling that how do you know who to trust in some funny way? Because, you know, here we used to grow up with the idea that, you know, if you read it in a magazine, they knew what they were talking about. You know what I'm saying. And now there's a million competing voices. Mm-hmm. And it raises very interesting issues, I think, about publishing, traditional publishing, electronic mm-hmm. publishing. You know, there's a huge controversy that's been going on about literary bloggers versus people sure. like us, you know, and I don't think it's actually a competition. I think it's two entirely different enterprises. But that, I think, is what's making people feel anxious, because that's what was different then. It's not that the old way of doing things has died out. It's just that now, for the first time, anybody can publish. You know, everyone with a laptop computer is a person who's publishing right now. You know, and I think, you know, they may be... A lot of these people are sort of hiding under free speech, but you know what they are doing is publishing. What's interesting about the blogosphere, say, and I understand, although I'm not a big blog reader, but I understand there are, you know, the internet is I've said this a million times, the internet is like a printing press. It is neither good nor bad. It distributes, thanks, Mom. It just distributes, my mother's here, she's... you know, it just distributes texts, you know. And what's interesting about that, you know, is that anybody can say anything about anything and have it be published. And that used to not be the case.
And do you feel that's expanding literature, diminishing, or just making it more interesting?
I would say C, you know. I would say, well, because it is the most powerful medium for distribution of ideas in the history of the planet. You know, that's a great thing. You know, you can have discussions about books with people and living in Timbuktu, and why not? And, you know, ideas zip back and forth. That's all great. What I think the problem is, to go to the sore, sensitive point that people are interested in, is what, to my mind, you know, the problem with... that kind of criticism is there is, and it's interrelated, there is no authority and there is no responsibility, right? You know,
yeah.
When I publish an article about something, I can't just say anything that I want, because Bob Silvers is going to say, well, are you sure that's fair? And are you sure you're not taking that quote out of context? Mm. And is the quote accurate? Mm. Because there's some little elf checking on that. And, you know, and I think it makes a difference. Mm. I think it makes a difference, because, and what the bloggers always say, because I've had some tussles, is, well, you know, if we're wrong, someone will correct it. And I will say, why have a thing that's wrong buzzing around to 30 million households? Mm. Because that you can't pull back. So I think that, unlike what we do, and I will say this, and I don't care if everyone hates me tomorrow, you know, well, there is no, it doesn't seem there's any sense of responsibility in that world. It's just people saying what they think. And I don't think that's what we do, actually. I don't know what you think.
What do you think, James? Do you read blogs?
I do read blogs, and I actually think some of the literary blogs are better than that. And are posting essays and so on that are not uninteresting. The problem, as you suggest, comes in the awful thing of the comment. You know, you read these pieces now and you've got the little blue thing at the top and you think, why is the blue thing only halfway down? Is this a 100,000-word piece? And you think, no, it's a 2,000-word piece, but there are 450 stupid comments at the bottom of it. It's the world of the totally, as you say, and there I think the rule is sanctioned ignorance, and indeed there's a pattern, which, you know, I think probably came from cable TV, or maybe essentially the two forms arose at the same time. The pattern goes something like this. I won't use my name because I'll use yours instead. Mendelssohn's just written a savage piece about X. I haven't read the book yet, and I can't get much of the review because there's a wall around it. But here's a paragraph. So then the paragraph goes up, and then 54 people write in and say, absolutely appalling what Mendelssohn's saying about this book. I mean, I haven't read the book yet, but as far as I can see from the review, it's disgraceful. does it? And that's how it goes on. And by the time you get to the bottom of this world of commentary, it is sort of, you know, it's the people that didn't even make it into Pope's Dunciad are having their say. So it's yeah. But as it were, at the top of the screen, when people are and some of them have been friends and some of them have been foes of me, when people are, you know, there are, you know what it's like. There are people with their own aesthetic agendas are writing essays about fiction or whatever. That can be relatively interesting. There's something going on there, but
there's plenty of. Great stuff, you know. But I think, you know, this is also maybe sort of the 800-pound gorilla, but, and this may just reflect a kind of antiquated, again, training on my part, but I think there's such a thing as expertise. You know, as I say at the beginning of my book, the word critic comes from the word to judge, and you cannot judge a thing if you don't know anything. You know, and I quite often think that people who open literary blogs, you know, great, you have an opinion about Herman Melville. Giga's into hay, you know, but it's like me opening a blog on brain surgery. And you know what? There's nothing to prevent me from doing that. And people may, for all I know, read my blog and go do an operation and kill somebody. You know, and I think that's the difference for me, is that I don't think what we are engaged in is airing our opinions. Whatever we are, and we have very different backgrounds, very different attitudes about things, but that you are trained, and this is something that I think we actually both do in a different way, but what we are interested in is sort of explaining to people how you pay attention to a text, you know, that it's not just it made me feel good or it reminded me of my boyfriend in high school or whatever. No, that's not what it's about. And that what seems to me problematic, let's say, because I'm generous, about this other thing is that it just seems incredible to me that you could just say anything about anything because that's how you feel about it. That just may mark, and I'm willing to admit that just may mark me as a kind of antique person. But I wouldn't dream of, and this may just be because we're right, I wouldn't dream of going public in print about a subject that I didn't feel I had a kind of rigorous training in. And that's, I guess, the difference.
And also,
And I may be wrong, you know, and I'm not saying people shouldn't have opinions about books, but that's not what we do. Actually, and I think that is in this day and age, you know, where the lines between public and private have been completely eroded, that's what I think is a line I want to keep drawing in the sand. Mm. That, you know, I think I know something about that. I don't know about most other things, but I do know about these things, and that's why I write about them. It's not just because I have a feeling about theater, you know.
And you use the word attention, and I think a lot of this has to do with attention span, too. I mean, James was talking before about the 50s. If you take a paragraph of Bellow from the 50s, and if you take a paragraph of Dave Eggers, say now, it'll look different, it'll feel different. You were talking a lot about screens, and screens teach us to take in information in a very, very different way. One of the most interesting things about your new book is that potentially it's a long, beautifully flowing 250-page article or essay, argument, but you break it up into little sections, and it could be that they're sort of broken up like Wittgenstein or Aristotle or something, but it more seems to have to do with people are better able to take in one page at a time now, and all this will go down more easily if you say this is point six and then have a lot of blank space and this is point seven. And I was wondering if you broke it up because of attention span or because...
No, I didn't actually. I broke it up because I was just writing... it was coming out in sort of 6,000-word chapters, so they were like lectures, and it was too pedagogical, and I just got stuck, and it wasn't my idea. My editor...
So he was thinking of attention span, maybe?
No, I don't know. I think he was thinking it was stodgy as it was, and he was right. And he wonderfully said, well, you know, I'm thinking the Tractatus. And I said, what, you mean Wittgenstein? He said, yeah. I said, don't be silly. He said, yeah. Numbered paragraphs. Yeah. So absurd and pretentious as it sounds, the idea was then, and then it did free me to you know, I could sort of contradict myself. I could alight on something just for a line or two, and then go back. And of course, there are plenty of examples of that in criticism of the sort of aphoristic or the paragraph-like form. You know, Roland Barthes does it a little bit occasionally, and I think who is it? T.J. Clark did a sort of version of that recently in art criticism, and then more augustly, you know, going back. But yes, it seems to be a form that serves one nicely. I think you're right about screens. I think, for instance, that writing. This is just a cranky thing of mine, but I think that writing, because I see it in my own writing, is that writing on a computer shortens one's paragraphs because there's a sort of anxiety about the text that's disappeared off the top of the screen. Do you know what I mean? And that is different. I mean, when you have a piece of paper, of paper in front of you, if you want to write a long paragraph, it's all there in front of you on the page, and then. If it's behind, you just flick behind and see how long the paragraph, you know, does it make sense and so on. But the screen, I know it myself, the thing's disappeared off the top, and then you have to go and, you know, you scroll back to see, okay, now it's time for a break.
Get a bigger monitor.
and reading and writing emails changes the way one thinks of the sentence.
Of course,
in the paragraph too, dramatically.
Yeah. Sure.
You know, Daniel was just mentioning seriousness, which I think is one of the things that, bringing a certain. Aesthetic standards and moral, well, I won't say earnestness, but sincerity to the business. And I'm wondering, where do you find seriousness in the 21st century? Where are the places of hope that both of you look to continue this great tradition?
Certainly, as I was saying in criticism, I'm very hopeful. Cynthia Ozick wrote something. A year ago or so in Harper's about sort of criticism and realism and so on, and I didn't necessarily agree with all of it, but one of the things she said in it, what I didn't agree with was that it was very much a kind of, you know, we can't go back to the 50s, we can't regain Trilling and Rav and so on. And then she gave a list of sort of working critics who she admired, and I think we were both on that list, and I felt actually it could have been doubled or tripled quite easily. Mm-hmm. And then if you've got sort of 30 or 40 names, some of them academics, some of them working journalists who are all writing about poems and plays and novels, it's not a bad place to be in at all. Mm. So there's plenty of seriousness in literary culture, and God, I'm sounding very Pollyanna-ish, but I think that there are lots of serious novelists, too, working at the moment. I just reviewed one, Marilyn Robinson. Mm. Whatever one feels about the forms in which she works her thing, and this novel in some ways is much more conventional than either of the last two, it's a gravely serious business that she's involved in, which I mean she's treating nothing less than the fate of the soul. So
I mean, your book in some ways is a record of disappointments, lots of things that don't meet the standards. But where are the places you find that do meet them?
Well, I have to say. You know, as a person who enjoys. Popular culture very much, you know. I think there's a lot of seriousness in Battlestar Galactica, and I do. But I, you know, the older I get, the more I'm aware of all of the really serious stuff that I still haven't read. So it seems, you know, you realize you've got more time behind you than in front of you. I would much rather, like I've been reading Trollope for the first time, lots and lots of Trollope, and I thought, am I gonna read some new novel by a 33-year-old Brooklyn guy who can't get his life together, and that's what the novel's about, or am I gonna read Trollope? I mean, come on. And it doesn't mean I don't like, you know, contemporary novels, but I do find this funny thing happening, which is I feel like I wanna play catch up. I'm always catching up, like I realize how immense is the amount of really serious stuff that I've never gotten to. So I find myself much more and more looking backwards. I hope not fatally, but I like to think that my live interest in many aspects of pop culture rescues me from being a total fogey, you know. But I think there's a lot out there. Again, I think the problem is that there's more static now, maybe, than there ever was, or because this is our moment, we hear it more, literally everywhere you go. Like you say, there are no quiet moments. And I think the thing that James has always been interested in that I think is a crucial thing to latch on to is the idea of quietness and privacy. That, one thing that, and as a champion of other kinds of literature, I'll acknowledge that one thing about novels in particular, but all books, is that it's a private experience. You know, it's not something that you can do. You know, even great theater, you have to do with lots of other people, you know, unless you're the Queen of England, I guess, but... And so I think that is what I worry about, is, and I see this in my students, the kind of anxiety about being disconnected from the static and just being alone with the text, which is, of course, why people of our generation say that was why you liked it. You wanted to go in your room and be together with the novel. And that, I think, is a cause for concern, as optimistic as I often try to be. I think that the ability to be private is something that you see disappearing. All you have to do is, as I do very often, ride New Jersey Transit, and you see people cannot be, you never see people reading anymore. Everyone's on a phone watching a movie, being connected, doing their emails, and I do this too, so it's not like I'm some high and mighty person, and that, I think, is interesting because, a form of public transportation in New York City used to be an object filled with people reading books and newspapers and magazines. And now they're all connected. And that, I think, is changing how people read. That, I think, is a material difference in culture.
Well, I'd love to ask you about the difference between Wilde and Houseman and looking backwards. And I've been waiting 10 years to attack James about Pynchon. But all of you have diligently written your questions. So, Paul, why don't you...
Well, we have many, many questions, about 45, and I will read about 52 of them to you.
Is that with the person walking around with the sign?
Yes, I thought
somebody's lights were on. For the past hour, I'm looking at this guy walking around with the card, and I thought...
The first question for you, Daniel, is, are your lights still on? No. To the three of you, are there times when, as Isherwood wrote in the New York Times, the muses are in retreat, creativity will be stymied for decades, leading to a cultural blight? And are we in such a time because of an overemphasis on pop culture? We might begin actually with you, Daniel.
I'm torn when I hear a question like this because the fogeyish part of me wants to say, yes, it's also terrible. And then, if you look at the history of culture, it's pretty much been the same the whole time, which is, there's some people doing great stuff and a lot of people doing junky stuff. I don't think particularly... when you talk about creativity, I think that's a very big subject. There are people creating things all the time. And I think that, our obligation, especially as a critic, because you're trying to read the culture, is not to be distracted by your own panic and to try and have a wider view, maybe. I don't think we're in a particularly... as compared to, say, the Elizabethans or... Periclean Athens, there was always a lot of crap being produced. It just never got it. They didn't have, the internet, so it's not still with us. Only the good stuff lasted. You know what I mean? So I would be wary of passing judgment on our moment, but again, because we're not out of it enough to see what it adds up to.
It's just like, everybody thinks his own family is the most troubled in the world, and the same applies to one's own time, I think. So I'm fully in agreement.
What do you think about novels, short stories, and articles being adapted for film, television, and even theater As this becomes more common and frequent, one wonders if eventually film could even exist without literature.
Hmm. These are very big questions. I think, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I think generally, the novelistic adaptations are less successful, aren't they? And the reason that something like The First Brideshead Revisited worked so well was that the filmmakers reserved for themselves a novelistic length of time. That's the thing that's hardest to do, capture that passage of time, and clearly compacting it down to 2 hours isn't going to work. And then, of course, film generally finds interiority hard to do, so has to find ways of dramatizing interiority or dramatizing descriptions of someone thinking, which will mean putting it into dialogue, which will then mean generally making things more explicit in some way than they actually were in the fiction. So I expect nothing from adaptations, and I'm pleasantly surprised when one or two succeed.
Well, I'd be out of a job if they weren't adapting film. So I don't see a Bob Silvers is laughing. You know, here again, I would argue for perspective. You know, in the early 19th century, people used to grumble because every hot new novel got turned into an opera. And now we think that the operas are great high works of art that we have to curate and protect and cherish, right? But I'm not saying that these adaptations are going to turn out to be good. I'm just saying... Mm.
They might.
You know, well, no, but what does it matter? You know, no adaptation of a great work of literature that was terrible ever hurt the great work of literature.
Right.
I think it's safe to say. And in a case like Brideshead, the adaptation was one of the rare examples of the adaptation actually better than the original.
Yeah, it was.
Right? You know, so yeah. I think Evelyn Waugh's estate should be very happy about that adaptation. So I don't think it hurts. I am very interested right now, and I think this may be what the asker of the question was sort of concerned about, is there's a kind of sense of recycling lately, you know, that and it's recycling from, as it were, unworthy objects. So first you have the Little Mermaid, the cutesy cartoon that becomes Little Mermaid, the unspeakable Broadway musical, which is now going to be the Little Mermaid, the cartoon of the musical, and then there will be a musical out of that cartoon, you know, and there's very much a sense of that. And that, you know, but that's just schlock, and I don't think it does any permanent damage, I don't think, you know, really.
Yeah, I don't think film could exist without the novel, which is why the Hollywood studios are so greedily optioning every book that comes out. And as you were saying, you know, Henry James, Jane Austen, and Somerset Maugham are having wonderful second and third careers long after their deaths,
right?
Thanks
and
to Hollywood.
Think of great movies that were just great movies that, of course, weren't good adaptations, but... You know, of course, I can't think of one. You know, but my father's sitting here with The Lady Knitting. I can't think of the name of the book. The French Revolution, Dickens, hello. Yeah. Thank you.
Jane Eyre.
My mother says Jane Eyre. You know, so there's been Wuthering Heights. You know, there have been fabulous movies made out of books that aren't so great, you know. I mean, you know, that are just different and wonderful. Mm. Film is different.
James, a very quick question for you. Where did James Wood learn the art of reading? He named a university but didn't tell us which one.
Oh, it was Cambridge University. And I won't give a long answer because I don't think it deserves one, but going back to what Daniel was saying about how he feels about his students and how good they are, but also how there's always been a lot of, you know, rubbish around in the culture, and this idea that standards somehow were a lot higher. It was at Cambridge that that the academic I.A. Richards in the 1920s decided to do an experiment, which was he brought in some poems by John Donne, and he, without the name attached to the poems, and gave them to his students and asked his students to write about them. And the results were very instructive because the students, a few of them had interesting things to say, but on the whole, they sort of guffawed at these poems and said, you know...
What did they do?
They laughed. I mean, they just sort of, you know, absurd, you know, overwrought. Line four is ridiculous. These metaphysical conceits don't work, and so on. And Richards had got the result that he secretly hoped for, which was there's a sort of chaos of subjectivity, and then it enabled Richards, as he saw it, to sort of bring a scientific rigor to the business of trying to teach people how to read. But so it was at Cambridge that Richards did this thing called practical criticism, a term that actually he got from Coleridge, but that became associated with that university, a mode of close reading, line by line, word by word, with elements of philology and so on.
I know when you use the word subjectivity, I am constantly asked how I make decisions like the one today of inviting the three of you to come. And I always tell people that they assume too much, but also that it's an informed subjectivity. Mm-hmm. It's a subjectivity that comes from years of actually doing what Pico was speaking about, which is the pleasure of being alone. And, you know, reading, I often quote this line from Winnicott. He talks in a wonderful chapter called the contribution of mothers to society. He says that the role is for the child to be alone in the presence of the mother. And in some way, reading, as your mother is here, Daniel, reading, you are never alone. Anyway, let me get to the next question. Mom is always there. The constructivist choreographer Fedor Lopukhov, I don't know him, a critic of critics, now I know a bit more about him, proposed that the only effective criticism in his field could be offered by individuals who knew at least as much about technique in the theatrical history as a poor schlub being criticized. Do you agree in the realm of literature and literary criticism?
that it can only be done by
someone who is as informed as a critic.
As a creator.
As the creator.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what that would mean exactly. You know, one of the irritating things about evolutionary biology, of which there are many, many irritating things, it seems to me, is this sort of new discovery of the mirror neuron. You know, this idea that if you're in the baseball park and you see the guy hit a home run or whatever, so I'm being very American. You didn't expect that, did you? But you see a guy hitting a home run, you know, it's now been proved that neurons are going off in your brain that are identical to the neurons going off in the slugger. Is that the right word? Okay.
You're batting 1,000.
Therefore, continue some evolutionary biologists, you know, that must be the historical, this must be the biological basis, rather, for sympathy and altruism, that we actually experience the same thing as the person being knocked down or by a car or hitting the home run. Obviously, as soon as I've said it, you realize that this cannot be true. It is not the same to spectate as it is to be the doer, whatever the similarities of brain function are. And so it must be the same in reviewing. I can't have exactly the same knowledge and experiences as the person I'm reviewing. That could never be. Indeed, I might know a lot more than the person I'm reviewing. That's fine too.
What he must be getting at, though, or she, is that Wilding thing that literary criticism is the only form in which the criticizer and the criticized are in the same medium. In other words, a ballet critic or a film critic is inherently performing a very different kind of task, which is how the critic in literature can trump the person he's criticizing.
Yeah, no, certainly. That's always been a great source of pleasure and excitement for me, and just the idea that you're swimming in the same medium and that's your great advantage over all other kinds of critics. Yeah.
But also, I think, you know, at the root of the question is a sense, a weird desire to erase the audience from the equation. You know, who are you making this stuff for? If you're a constructivist Russian choreographer, probably nobody. But, if a critic can't judge it because he's not the filmmaker, then how could the audience judge it? Who goes to see it? I think it's the whole thing is specious, you know. But you get this all the time. Well, if you ever tried to write a novel, you'd be a lot nicer, you know, or whatever. So, no, that's not how it works. Does a judge have to commit murder, you know?
My 15th Amazon reader review response, you know, of how fiction works, 15th and last so far, counting.
You're looking at it carefully every day.
Gives me one star, and it's headlined, "Obviously Wood Never Wrote a Novel." Now, I think at some philosophical level that's probably true, because it wasn't a good enough novel, but the fact is I did write a novel, it was published.
You spoke a little bit about the life of the critic, and here we have a question about something that just happened very recently. Does one want to attempt to read the death of David Foster Wallace's suicide as a literary gesture, or is that just too distasteful a suggestion? And there's a note, I'll terribly miss what he will not be writing in the future.
It doesn't seem to me a literary gesture. Of course, when the news of that terrible event came on Saturday, it was only natural that one was thinking, as one does, this is the nature of suicide, that it places the burden of explanation horribly on those who survive, that one was thinking of all the possible reasons, and in an idle way, no doubt one was probably thinking, was there some literary involvement? I don't mean as a gesture, I mean more like, was he not able to write, and was that what was the part of the problem? But I think it as far as one can tell, and I feel wrong even sort of commenting on this, but as far as one can tell from the obituary which quoted his father, it was a long many years of depression. That everything had been tried. Virginia Woolf didn't commit suicide as a literary gesture. She committed suicide because she knew she was going to get depressed again, and she couldn't bear that idea. It was worse than anything, and she had to end it.
I'm so dumbfounded by the question. I'm not sure what to say. The only literary gesture is writing. That's the only. I don't know what it means to be a literary. I literally don't know what it means. I do. What comes to mind is the young fellow I know who was at Columbia who was taking some kind of fancy theory course, and they were talking about death in this course, and the famous theorist professor had said something like, you know, that's not a text I'm ready to encounter or something, and I thought, oh, Mary, get over yourself, you know. I think one of the things that literature tells you is about, you know, the significance of life in a profound way. So to refer to the, you know, in any way as a gesture it just seems to me, I can't comment on it because it seems sort of grotesque. I don't know what to say.
James actually has some very powerful pages in his book that now seem both prophetic and even poignant about David Foster Wallace and how he had ingested and could, at 20, 30 pages at a stretch, embody the confusion and the fracturedness and the excess of the times. And I mean, there's something, when I reread James's book in the light of that death, it threw off, you know, sad, haunting resonances, I think.
Well, I mean, one thing I quoted was that Marvis Auden poem, The Novelist, where Auden says, you know, the poet can leap forward like a hussar, you know, with one phrase, can seize everything in an image, but the novelist has to learn how to be plain and awkward and must become the whole of boredom, is what Auden says. And he doesn't mean it. It sounds catty, and Lord knows Auden could make anything sound catty, but I don't think he meant it cattily. And when I quoted it in relation to Foster Wallace and said that he's very good at becoming the whole of boredom, I didn't mean it cattily either. Mm-hmm. That in some way that's there's that mimetic burden on the novelist, mm-hmm. and everything we've been talking about in the last hour is in some way a circling round that question of how the contemporary novelist responds to this particular reality. You know, there's all this stuff going on. So do you take it in and fill your text with it and alter your sentences on the basis of what's been taken in? And obviously, Wallace was fearless at doing that.
And between him and Marilynne Robinson, you have such an interesting...
Absolutely.
In contrast,
yeah.
Because
no.
She has built her structure.
It's
in
all about silence,
ageless
and
world,
paring
right?
down. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
On this very stage, I recall having Pierre Bayard and Umberto Eco, and Pierre Bayard wrote this quite comical book called "How to Talk About Books You Haven't Read."
Mm.
Have you read that book?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, it's no, it's fairly good, and it always brings back to my mind years and years. Please, what were you?
No, I just have. I can't talk about it. But
years and years and years of teaching, and my favorite comment still remains: one day, a student who always had interesting things to say, but were mostly sort of off, and perhaps one might even dare say wrong. And one day, I said to him, "Michael, have you actually read Bartleby the Scrivener?" And he said, "Not personally." Thank you very much.